In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow. There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the house of cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Medium, clairvoyant, psychic, numerologist, astrologer Maurice Amder will join me. I don't just talk about UFOs and ghosts on this program. Yes, I talk about aliens and the paranormal a lot, but I work with a pretty broad canvas. And from time to time, I also discuss conspiracies and cover-ups. These are things Don Jeffries spends a lot of time thinking about, writing about, and talking about. In fact, the two of us have spent a lot of time talking about these things together over the years on this program, on Coast to Coast AM, on my podcast. And Don is here this hour. Don has been researching the JFK assassination since the mid-1970s when he was a teenage volunteer for Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry. He's very active on all the JFK assassination forums. He's been a moderator on the London Spartacus Education Forum for several years. His first published book, the acclaimed 2007 novel The Unreals, has been compared to Alice in Wonderland and The Wizard of Oz. He's since focused on works of nonfiction, beginning with Hidden History, an encyclopedia of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics, Survival of the Richest, how the corruption of the marketplace and the disparity of wealth created the greatest conspiracy of all time, Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963, Bullyocracy, how the social hierarchy enables bullies to rule schools, workplaces, and society at large. On Borrowed Fame, Money, Mysteries, and Corruption in the Entertainment World. He's now working on a another edition of Hidden History, and well, another book maybe we'll talk about. I don't want to tell tales out of school, but you can read his terrific essays at donaldjeffries.substack.com. He's also the host of the radio program I Protest. Don, welcome back to the show. How are you, my friend?
Just fine, Richard. So it's always so it's a great pleasure and an honor to talk with you.
You know, I think it just occurred to me, I should update your website. Do they even have these JFK forums? I mean, do they have forums anymore?
I meant to tell you, I think that was when I first had the first Hidden History come out, because, I don't even know. I doubt I'm still a moderator there. I haven't posted there for a long time. So, I need to take that stuff out about the forum, because to be honest with you, the JFK research community has not given me any support at all with the book. To me, it's amazing that Hidden History did really well, because I originally put that in my introduction because I thought that would be a natural for me, but they've ignored it pretty much, to put it that way. So there's no point in even having, it's not a part of me anymore anyhow. So I need to update that that bio a bit.
That's interesting. You haven't received any support from the JFK assassination, if we can call it a community, in your work and in uncovering, you know, more corruption in American history. Why is that? Why do they not support you?
Yeah, you know, it's having been in that community since the mid-70s, when I was a teenager with Mark Lane, it's always been so dysfunctional. And it mirrors, you know, the society. I write a lot about American dysfunction. I don't know how it is in Canada, but here it's just awful. Family dysfunction especially. But the JFK assassination research community has always been that way. Even before I came along, there was a lot of infighting. But now it's just... there's not even any point in going there. As I'm writing Hidden History 3, which I'm finishing up, I've dealt with some of them and relied on some of them. And it's not there are some that are supportive, but by and large, no. And there's a lot of big egos, difficult personalities. And unfortunately, you know, the establishment, when they smear, when they smear us so-called conspiracy theorists, a lot of those personalities can fit the bill. They can act that way, and you know, you're kind of hard. So, like, you know, it is what it is, and there's a lot of petty jealousy and things like that too, I think. But I really don't know why they don't tend to support each other very much at all. So it's not just me, but you know, the book did great in spite of it, and but it wasn't due to any kind of support from the community.
It kind of mirrors the UFO community, I think, in that regard. I don't know how closely you follow that arena, but this is characterized by constant infighting, tearing somebody down, accusing the other one of being controlled opposition. Same sort of thing with the JFK crowd, right?
Yes. I mean, you can find it everywhere. UFO, and again, the UFO research community attracts those kind of personalities. And does suggest, I mean, there, you know, people tell me all the time, I'm even keeled. I don't get upset at people. I don't get down in the gutter with them, which infuriates them, really. You know, they call you names and you maintain your calm. That's the way to get them really freaked out. But I don't go there. That's just my style. But that's not the style of very many that research. 9/11 research is the same kind of way.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's, I don't know why it is. And it's just, I've met some decent people that I can get along with it, but by and large, it's difficult personalities, even the ones that do great work. You know, Mark Lane had a pretty, he wasn't really that bad. Harold Weisberg, another guy who I loved, and he was my hero, but he was the king of difficult personalities. Really, really like a grumpy old man, curmudgeon. I mean, he just fit that bill perfectly.
Yeah. I wonder if it's because people become so invested in a particular theory. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's take 9/11 as an example and controlled demolition.
Yeah.
And so they become so wrapped up in that, it almost becomes part of their identity or the entirety of their identity. And so to quibble or to argue against, you know, that particular facet of 9/11 is then a personal attack.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And that's why I don't... You know, people tell me about JFK or anything, and they tell, you know, say, who do you think killed JFK? I said, I don't know. I said, but I do know that after studying this thing for 40 some years, the one thing that conclusively that they proved inadvertently was that Lee Harvey Oswald did. So he didn't do it. And they've invested a lot of time and energy into telling you that he did. And they've covered a lot of stuff up. So Now, you can do the math. I mean, it just stands to reason. Those covering up, those forces, that's probably where the conspiracy came from. But I don't pretend to know the truth. Same thing with 9/11. I'm aware there's a lot of questions about holograms and were there planes and what struck the Pentagon. I mean, I know all that. But I'm not going to get that vested in it that I think someone's a disinfo agent because they see this or that. Again, what they told you happened is a fairy tale. It wasn't 19 crazed Arabs armed with box cutters and plastic knives by, some 6'8" tallest guy in the Middle East, directing things from a cave. I mean, that's absurd. While they, the planes flew around for an hour and a half, while the biggest military power the world has ever seen did nothing to try to stop them. So that story makes no sense. So then you go from there, and who's covering it up? Okay, the easiest thing to say is 9/11 was an inside job. It was some kind of inside job, I think. But regardless, they're lying to you. That's what I say about everything now, Richard. That's my tack when people tell me about anything. I said, look, they're lying to you about everything. So I don't discount anything, flat earth, hollow earth, anything, because we've been lied to about everything. I'm not going to poo-poo anything. I'll listen to anything because I understand that at this point, people in charge, we really can't trust them about anything. I mean, if they're telling you it's raining outside, then don't bring an umbrella. I mean, that's the level of trust I have for them.
Yeah, the questions are more important than the answers. I mean, people who claim they have the answers, all the answers, you run away from those people. It's the questions that are more important, I think, at this point. And as you say, we question everything. Hidden History. The first one came out. Then you did an updated version with a foreword by Roger Stone.
Right.
Now you're working on, or you've submitted, it's ready to go, right? Hidden History. This is Hidden History 3.
Yeah, because Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 70s, 76, 1963, which had a foreword by Ron Paul, that was really Hidden History, too, and that's what I wanted to call it. But for some reason, the publisher didn't want that. So they may not like Hidden History 3 either. But I've discovered, Richard, after having these books published, that the Hidden History book and the Crimes and Cover-Up books, the books about hidden history, those are the ones people buy. They outsell all the others, by not even close. Hidden History still sells way more than all the others. So, and it's something I love doing. So I said, okay, why not try to sell more books? So this is going to be called, unless they change the title, Hidden History 3, More from the American Memory Hole. And I had so much material because I have like a lot of people help me, but I have three researchers who were volunteers, but they did so much work. And, I call them out as much as I can. Bob Wilson, Chris Graves, and Peter Seacost, they just constantly provided me with, information. I couldn't have found them all on my own. So very appreciative of that. But they sent me so much stuff that eventually I had to cut a lot of the book out, and because it's still like almost 500 pages. But I said, well, I've got Hidden History 4 here, based on the way. So I've already got a good start on that. And I haven't even approached Trump. So all Trump stuff is going to be at Hidden History 4. And that's a huge amount right there. This one just basically goes over some of the same stuff, but it deep dives back into the founding of the Republic, a lot more in the Civil War and more in the Mexican-American War, where a lot of the stuff started. A lot of our we didn't really have an interventionist foreign policy until Woodrow Wilson, so I focus a lot on Wilson and the things he did that people don't realize. We started an interventionist foreign policy, things he did in Haiti, invaded Mexico like 9 times or something when he was sent troops. This is Hidden History, what people don't know. Our conduct in the Philippines, Theodore Roosevelt. It's horrible stuff. And I have reports in there, and I got a lot of it from Howard Zinn, who a lot of people have compared me to him. And I never had read his work before, People's History of the United States. But he's far left on a lot of that. I wouldn't have agreed with him on a lot of things. But he's very good about a lot of this populist stuff where the American military did. I have several Indian massacres that really haven't talked about very much that happened in the history. And then again, what happened in the Philippines, Haiti, and Dominican Republic. And there you see the similarities, the pattern. And it goes back to, in Crimes and Cover-Ups, I wrote about the scorched earth and the total war strategy under Lincoln's generals. Well, you can see that just became entrenched. And you saw the same kinds of things, the theft, lots of theft. They were stealing property left and right everywhere they went. And that's what happened under Sherman, especially General Sherman, that extortion racket. He was just stealing, as they swept through the South. So we see that. We see lots of rapes, lots of horrible treatment of children. So just, really, and I'm not trying to be like an American doing this, but.
That was my next question.
How
do you feel about America? What do we mean by America? Not the yeah. government, but the ideal of America, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the ideal of what America is supposed to stand for. I mean, obviously, it hasn't lived up to that. But how do you feel about your country?
Well, I was in a film. I have credits on IMDb now because it's actually on there, but it still has never been released. And Jesse Ventura, Gerald Celente, a lot of people were in it. I was honored to be in it, but the title of the movie kind of sums up my beliefs. And it's that I love my country, but I hate what they're doing. And that's the way I feel about it. The system of government, and I think I'm, I've been accused of being a fanboy of the founding fathers, especially Thomas Jefferson. They'll probably maybe sugarcoat some of their stuff. And that's why I did try to put a few negative things that happened during the American Revolution in this book, because it wasn't perfect. But by and large, they were statesmen. And they created, even though I probably would not have supported the Constitution, like Jefferson and Patrick Henry, George Mason, most of those people didn't, as Patrick Henry said, he smelled a rat in the Constitutional Convention, because the Articles of Confederation, I think, were good. And there was more of a loose lip because it was really decentralized power. States were each individual states. And I think that's the best, have a decentralized power. That government is best, which governs the least, as Jefferson said. But when they, by putting a Bill of Rights in there, which is at the behest of Jefferson and George Mason, basically, George Mason, I write a lot about him in the book too. He's been forgotten, even though he's a university right around the corner from me, George Mason University, where ironically, he probably wouldn't be allowed to teach today. Just as Thomas Jefferson would not be allowed at the University of Virginia. You can guarantee that. So it's ironic that these named after these people. But once they wrote the Bill of Rights, I think that really tempered the power that was invested in the central government and the checks and balances that Madison came up with. I think it's the most perfect form of government. I mean, I can't argue with the anarchists too much anymore. When they talked to me now, I said, I don't have an answer for some of your arguments at this point. The authority is so bad now. I don't want anarchy, but I really can't argue with you too much on it. But if you're going to have a government, I think this is the best. It's never worked as intended. And I talk about judicial review in this book a lot. And we go back and look at the history of it. Jefferson, he was the first critic of judicial review. Nobody's talked about it in a very long time. And it shows how under John Marshall, those checks and balances, which were essential to the system working right, were three separate and equal branches where they would check the power of the other two. What happened is the Supreme Court right away, and I have the quotes from Jefferson. He saw what was happening right away. He said, this is not what's intended. And so we see in the recent decision here, Roe versus Wade, that's exactly what wasn't supposed to happen, but it wasn't supposed to happen in the original 1972 decision either. Because the Supreme Court was not supposed to legislate. You can look through the Constitution all you want. You're not going to see the word abortion in there. It doesn't address that issue. They couldn't even comprehend it, probably. But
well, so, if it's not in the Constitution, it belongs to the states.
Exactly, and so that's the argument. Under judicial review, both parties now, both the Democrats and the Republicans, they just hope to get a sympathetic judge. They said, let the courts decide, and that's a huge mistake, and that's. That's what we've been allowing to happen for, it's probably Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, certainly since Roe versus Wade. And that's why it's laughable when you see the left. You live by the sword, you die by the sword. I mean, they just lost in the Supreme Court the same way they won in 1972. Both decisions really are outside the powers of the judiciary. But it's interesting to see how they don't have exactly any kind of sportsmanship, because this is what you wanted.
But don't you see what the Supreme Court has done recently with not only Roe versus Wade, sending it back to the states as more of a remedy, also with and a check on the executive. So, for example, with the EPA, they have basically said the EPA has, which is an extension of the executive branch, they have overstepped. You can't tell a power generating plant in West Virginia how much carbon dioxide you can emit. So, and also with the decision on overturning a 100-year-old ban on concealed carry in New York, don't you see what the Supreme Court is doing now as one of the, like reassuming its role as a check and balance?
Well, I do. I see, yes, because they're rolling back some bad previous decisions of the Supreme Court. But my fear again is that both sides are still expecting the Supreme Court to be the arbiter of these things. In my opinion, and yes, they remedied something with Roe versus Wade and concealed weapons, but we need to look at this question of judicial review, and neither side will do it because both sides want to have, that's why there was so much emphasis on Trump getting the right judges in the Supreme Court, and that's what, and Democrats want to expand the court. They want to have somebody sympathetic. And this is what's wrong with our system now. We have we already had a justice system that was full of lots of horrible injustices and unfairness and inequality, but it has become so politicized now that, and when you have somebody like Steve Bannon or something, again, I'm not, but you know, that's a complete politicized prosecution, much as it was for Roger Stone, where he's going to walk into a courtroom that is presided over by almost certainly an Obama or Clinton appointee, guarantee, even if it's a Bush appointee, probably the same thing, and he won't have a chance because the judge will be overtly prejudiced against him. And again, Washington, D.C., that's why a little while back you had Durham, who couldn't even get that one conviction on Hillary Clinton's lawyer, because the jury pool base in Washington, D.C. is like 95% Democratic. So you're not going to get any convictions on the other side. And so, again, that's why I think the Republicans, the conservatives, are not being very wise, because they need to be realistic here and say the courts aren't the remedy. I would like to see some type of real reform. But again, our court system, it's as messed up as everything else because it's been completely politicized. And, you know, one of the things I've been doing for the last couple of years, I don't know if I'll ever write a book on it exclusively because it'll just be another book like Bullyocracy and Survival of the Richest and On Borrowed Fame that probably won't sell that well because, you know, people don't really want the books that they read by me are about hidden history, conspiracy stuff. But I would love to write a book about our legal system, our injustice system, from top to bottom, from, you know, from police. And I do have, in Hidden History 3, I have a history of asset forfeiture laws. I think it's very important for us to know that because that's I don't know if you have that in Canada or not, but that is the basis for so much corruption in the United States because, and it became entrenched in the 80s where the police saw this incredible revenue source for them where they were, and the Supreme Court has upheld them a couple times to, disgraceful. One of the most famous cases, a woman.
Don, pardon the interruption. I'm going to take a quick time out. We'll come back and we'll get into asset forfeiture laws. Don Jeffries is with us. And again, check out his essays. I protest. DonaldJeffries.substack.com. DonaldJeffries.substack.com. Back with more of our conversation right after these.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
We're back with Don Jeffries, and we can look forward to Hidden History 3. When is that due in bookstores, Don?
Well, I've told the publisher about it. I haven't even sent it yet. I'm still digging on a couple things that I'm trying to resolve before publication. It's down the road. I mean, and that's assuming that Skyhorse, my primary publisher, takes. I mean, they've taken three of my books, but it's altogether, you know, possible they may not. And if that's the case, I have a couple alternatives.
Okay.
It's going to be a little while.
I protest, which, you know, this is a collection of your essays. And I mentioned DonaldJeffries.substack.com. There's also the radio show I Protest. How do we listen to that?
Yeah, it's on Rockfin now. Rockfin is becoming Substack is the Rockfin is the video equivalent, I guess, or the audio equivalent of Substack is to literary world. Or Substack is, you know, people like Glenn Greenwald, Naomi Wolf, my friend, more and more people are flocking there because it's a free speech platform. Don't censor. You can pretty much say what you want there. So I don't worry at all that I'm going to be censored or anything like I do on social media. And so it's great. And I'm getting more and more people there. It's people are supporting it. I have a pay option there, so I can even make a little money if people. But everything I offer is for free. I'm a populist, so I can have a paywall. But if people want to help, wonderful, and some have. But Rockfin, Rokfin, Rockfin.com. Again, lots of good people over there. Jimmy Dore, Tim Tripoli, Richard Gage, 9/11 Truth. More and more people are flocking there as well. Primetime 99, Alex Stein. There's more and more people there, and it's getting a good audience. And it live streams. So we live stream every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern. Rockfin and my social media. Now, my social media that got by far the biggest attention was YouTube, but YouTube keeps banning me or stopping me from live streaming. So I haven't been able to live stream lately, but when I do, it's nice as another thing. But so it's mainly on Rockfin. And then I have Jeff Rentz's network, which is a pretty big network. And he takes all my shows and they play them, I think, four times a week on their schedule. At some point, for me there, and I'm on Jeff Rentz every Monday as well. I'm Eastern, so those are nice platforms, and you know, people want to can hear me there. And the Donald Jeffrey show is on hiatus, but I'll be bringing that back pretty soon. There's a couple of my friends are starting up a network, and we'll be doing that as well.
All right, we were talking about asset forfeiture. In the United States, which you say is a big scam. What is asset forfeiture?
No, it's basically the idea that it actually goes back, but I found the history of it. It went back to beginning of the Republic. They actually had a couple of decisions, but they've always been wrong about it because basically it's claiming that property associated with the crime can be confiscated by the government. And so even if it's loosely associated, so let's say, you know, you and I have kids. If we had been on the unlucky side of asset forfeiture and if our kids happened to be, you know, selling marijuana in the house, let's say, to one of their friends comes over and they sell a bag of dope to them, under asset forfeiture, if that transaction took place in our house, they can take our house away from us. And we have a hard time getting it back. And the Supreme Court has upheld their ability to do this. In one notable decision, this is one of the greatest injustices. I think the Supreme Court ruled 8-1. I think it was under the Rehnquist Supreme Court, I think. It was just disgraceful. This woman, her husband went and visited a prostitute, and they had sex in her car. So the police confiscated the car. And she naturally objected, that's my car. And no, I said, no, this is associated with the crime. It belongs to us now. And that's what they can do. So she took it all the way to the Supreme Court protesting, and the Supreme Court ruled that no, they had the right to take her car. So she didn't get her car back. And I have lots of stories that'll be in the book of people that, you know, were arrested for speeding, and they were, you know, they had large amounts of cash on them. The police confiscated the cash because they had suspicion to believe it might have been involved in drugs. They had no evidence. It's amazing. And again, the worst part is like when parents or something that aren't associated with anything, they're not really any crimes most of the time anyhow, but they lose something, they lose their house, or lose life. And nobody's talking about it. And I believe that it's when you see the cops going wild, videos and all that stuff, and you saw it with Uvalde, you know, originally in Texas, we saw the other side of that where literally they stood and did nothing while somebody was shooting kids inside of school. I mean, how any of those cops could still have a job is beyond me. I mean, I can't think of a bigger dereliction of duty in the history of the world, but that's because the policing for profit and the basis of policing for profit is asset forfeiture. That's why they hide behind bushes and you love to pass out tickets for legal U-turns and all that kind of stuff, because that brings in revenue. Stopping a shooting is not going to bring in revenue. It's dangerous. So that's, you know, that's why they don't do it. So, and it needs to be completely revamped, and nobody's talking about it. I mean, people are criticizing those cops, but nobody's talking about what's at the basis of it. And that is that they certainly shouldn't have a right to be stealing your property, especially if you have nothing to do with it. But, you know, that's where we are now. And that it's part and parcel of what is just a horrible, I don't know how your justice system is up there. I tremble at the prospect. That's why I try to keep my nose clean and when I'm saying stuff, because I know how many thought crimes are out there now. I tremble at the prospect of facing our justice system because I know how bad the juries are and how they'll convict anybody. They have no concept of reasonable doubt. And I know how the average defendant gets a public defender because they can't afford a real lawyer, and they'll spend less than 5 minutes with them, and they'll get you to plead. You know, you got to plead guilty. I didn't do it. I don't care. I'm not representing. That's the system. And so it's, but nobody's, and that's the liberal in me. You know, that's when I started out, you know, as an ACLU card carrying member, people, and now the ACLU doesn't. They literally don't care about civil liberties anymore. So it's just a mess here. I never run out of things to talk or write about, though.
Speaking of, you know, writing and being kicked off YouTube and so forth, in your I Protest collection of essays on Substack, you write about fact checkers and shadow bans. What's happening with you on Facebook and Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing is that if you don't know what shadow bans are, they don't like, and of course, people think you're a dissentoid. They think I work with the CIA or something because how are you still, you know, I never get any warnings, nothing. I've never gotten a warning, never had up on Facebook or Twitter. And I've certainly been radical as good. I do say the same things there that I say here. But I started noticing, especially after COVID, because I was getting hundreds of reactions to my. I was skeptical of the COVID narrative from the very beginning. Very few. I lost a lot of friends, and eventually Facebook caught up to us. And they, but instead of banning me, just started noticing, hey, I'm getting almost no responses to my posts now. So what they do is they limit. They don't let it get out to very many people. But you suddenly see you don't have it. And it's Twitter. It's the same thing. I never had as big an impact on Twitter because I didn't use it as much. But same kind of thing. People told me I don't see it. So they don't see them. So you're basically, they'll let you post, but it's only going out to a handful of people. Even though I have Facebook, I have a maximum of 5,000 friends. Theoretically, I should have a huge response on it. But like I posted something now the other day, I posted something the other day, and I did get a couple hundred responses. Sometimes it gets through, but but most of the time it does. Like today, I posted something about the 69-year-old grandmother down here who has breast cancer. Places a prospect of months in prison, insurrectionists. It's a horrible story. I think I had two reactions out of 5,000 friends. So that's what that is. The fact checkers, I just, the fact checkers used to on my COVID, so, but I stopped pretty much writing about COVID because nobody's seeing it. And plus, I've lost so many friends about it. So I write about it on Substack if I want to do it or something. But they would just, you know, say this has been determined to be, and of course, they're just, the fact checkers, we've been able to figure out who they are. They're typically college students who have famous parents or wealthy parents. And so they've become, you know, ridiculous. They're just they're basically Snopes. They're regurgitating establishment facts to counter because you're questioning something. So actually, that's not true. And so that was the title of it was just, you know, an attempt to say how I feel about it. I think this is, that's why I gravitated to Substack and why I like Rockfin because, I don't like censorship. And unfortunately, all the rest of the media, we thought maybe with the Elon Musk, when he was making noise about that maybe Twitter is going to be free. But then I don't know if that was a whole, you know.
Were you disappointed? Were you disappointed? Or are you also suspicious of someone like an Elon Musk?
Well, I was suspicious of him. But like I told people, oh, don't you? I know his past. I've seen pictures of, you know, his wife and his mother and everything. I understand from the world he's coming from. And I know he supposedly wants to put a chip in everybody. I've heard all that. I understand that. But he was saying, I support anybody. If Hillary Clinton was saying what he was saying, I would have said, she's right. Yeah, I'm sincere. And maybe he wasn't. But he was saying free speech is important. We need to have free speech here. We got to stop banning people. How do you not support that? So I said, yeah, odds are just like when Trump was running for president. This is probably a joke. He's not going to do this, but he was saying stuff that I agree with. So of course I said that's great. So if somebody says it, yeah, I'm not naive. People accuse me of being naive. Yes, I understand that, and it'll probably turn out to, you know, be that they won't be sincere about it. But when Elon Musk was saying that, of course I supported him. I guess and ultimately I'm disappointed and disillusioned that, and then he ended up, I guess, not getting it, but are backing out after they or they froze him out. I don't really even understand exactly what happened, but. No, of course, what he said, the important thing is what he was talking about. You have to agree with that. Free speech is important, but apparently the rest of the people at Twitter don't agree with that. So we thought, I thought we might have one social media platform that was not censored, but apparently they're all going back to business as usual.
Well, it's not over yet. I still think maybe he has a plan B in his hip pocket. We'll see. Don Jeffries is with us. We'll come back, continue to talk about his upcoming book, Hidden History 3. Again, donaldjeffries.substack.com, the website. Back with more in a moment. Stay with us.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Donald Jeffries is with us. And we're talking about his, a lot of things, but including his upcoming book, Hidden History 3. I wanted to spend a little bit of time on that, and I want to begin with, you call him the original conspiracy theorist. That was Senator Joe McCarthy, of course, who's been vilified in the history books, you know, because of the Red Scare and the persecution of Hollywood screenwriters and directors who had some, maybe some tenuous link to the Communist Party. In other cases, they had a very firm link with the Communist Party. Tell me a little bit about why you think Joe McCarthy got such a raw deal.
Well, I just think from just what you said as well, and that's the general impression of him, is that he really, there was a witch hunt in the 50s, and people were unfairly maligned for their beliefs. But McCarthy wasn't really doing that. People talk about the Hollywood and everything, and that all happened under the House Un-American Activities Committee, which is an Orwellian sounding name, but it was in the House. McCarthy was in the Senate. He had nothing to do with that at all. And if people don't know the name of Owen J. Parnell, he was the head of that committee. Nobody knows him. It's not, they don't say Parnellism, but instead they talk about McCarthy. McCarthy was going after, strictly focusing on what he thought was communist influence, Soviet influence in the government. And he really got into deep water when he started focusing on the army. Because, I mean, that's obviously goes to the heart of what I think was a phony Cold War. And I think McCarthy was revealing that. And if you go and look at what he, he was dramatic and he was naive, but he, as I said, he was the first conspiracy theorist regarding Pearl Harbor. He was the first one to look into that and saying, hey, they had foreknowledge. He knew sin. It was crimes and cover-ups. I think I showed conclusively based on the work of a lot of other people, like John Tolan, going back to infamy, that Roosevelt did have foreknowledge. It was a plan. They wanted to get us into the war, and they were willing to sacrifice men to do it. And that's what happened. And McCarthy, unlike most of these other people too, had been a genuine war hero. They called him Pale Gunner Joe. He was a tailgate. He was in the fighting. He was firing from the tail of these planes. So regardless of what you think about war, he was really there, much as JFK was. So I have more respect for people like that than the chicken hawks that, like FDR, for instance, who supported every war, but was never going to get near one, even if he hadn't had the physical problems yet. But so McCarthy, I have lots of excerpts from his testimony when he was looking into Montauk, which is, he mentioned, he touched on, he didn't say Area 51, but he was touching on that. I talked about the July 1940, he was talking about July 1947 an awful lot. And so I think there were intimations, and other authors have thought, I don't go there because I can't prove it, but maybe he was already wondering about what was happening there. So he was doing some interesting work, say, from that point. And then, of course, anybody that dies as he did, he went in, he was 48 years old. He had complained of knee problems. He goes into Bethesda Naval Hospital of all places, and he dies 2 days later. We still don't know what he died from. No autopsy done, which is all too common in these high profile guy like that. We don't know. And I tried to track down descendants of these people. And I just thought, what do people in McCarthy's family think of him? Now, I knew he only had one daughter that he adopted as a baby right before he died, so he didn't even know. But I found out she died a couple years ago, not that far from me, actually. If I'd been quicker about it, maybe I could have talked to her. But she never discussed him her entire life. She refused to. His widow lived about 20-some years after that, wouldn't talk about him. He had like eight siblings or something like that. They wouldn't talk about him. One of his siblings died very strangely, like a year after. And I have all this in the book, but those are the kind of things that intrigued me. I looked for like George McClellan from the Civil War. I tried to look up his descendants as well. You just can't find any. And I think that these people that become demonized, McClellan in his day, certainly John McCarthy, one of the most demonized people ever. I feel for those people because I think they're usually unfairly demonized. And in McCarthy's case, he had the right kind of friends. You know, Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., you know, old Joe Kennedy was a good friend of his. And he was they're trying to distance themselves now from it. But for a long time, it was recorded that Joe McCarthy was the godmother to Robert F. Kennedy.
Sorry, you cut out there a little bit. Joe McCarthy was the
godfather to Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, who was Robert F. Kennedy's oldest child. Now, they try to claim he wasn't, but they claimed it for a long time. And he had dated a couple of the Kennedy sisters. They were friends. John F. Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy as well has got his start, you know, as you know, working for McCarthy's committee. And they remained kind of loyal to him. They would never really badmouth him. But McCarthy was friends with James Forrestal, too, good friends.
And we are looking forward to the publication of his next book, Hidden History 3. We were talking about Joe McCarthy dying at Bethesda Naval Hospital under very mysterious circumstances, goes in for maybe knee surgery or something and dies 2 days later. That's also where James Forrestal died, correct? Tell my listeners who James Forrestal was.
Yeah, he was Harry Truman's Secretary of Defense. He was the first Secretary of Defense. Up until that time, they called him Secretary of War. He was the first Secretary of Defense, the first modern Secretary of Defense. He supposedly jumped out of a window at the Naval Hospital. I don't think anybody that studied the case at all thinks he jumped out. McCarthy certainly didn't. McCarthy was good friends with him, and he actually wrote, he basically said they murdered him. It was interesting. And so Bethesda has a little bit of a timeline there. You have Forrestal, who also is good friends with the Kennedy family, by the way, who gets thrown out of a window, I think it's almost certain, and good friends with McCarthy. And Forrestal is the one who I use that quote all the time. He told McCarthy at one point, you know, McCarthy, you know, you're on the right track. You know, if there wasn't this huge conspiracy, once in a while, they'd make a mistake in our favor. I use that line all the time. This is not, you know, if this was all random and happenstance, then some good people would emerge sometimes. Justice would prevail sometimes, but it's always, people just expect it. They expect the injustice to win and evil to win. And that shouldn't happen naturally if it's all random. And that's what Forrestal thought. And McCarthy certainly thought it. And so Forrestal dies at Bethesda. McCarthy dies at Bethesda. And of course, JFK has the autopsy to end all autopsies. Bethesda, so they have quite a track record there. But I think these things are connected. That's what makes it hard for like the JFK research community, whatever, to handle me, because I draw these kinds of connections. I think history is a timeline, and I think there are these interesting connections everywhere. And so I think that in Crimes and Cover-Ups, I'm not left or right, as you know. In that book, I was defended Joseph McCarthy, but I also defended the Rosenbergs. Think that they're not going to find anybody else that does that balancing act. But again, I think that it was they were both victims of what I think was a phony Cold War. But McCarthy is, I don't know about restoring his reputation, but and I know I'll probably catch a lot of flack for it, but it is what it is. And I think he's gotten a bad rap. And I think people will agree once they read the new material I have on in the book.
Why was James Forrestal taken out, do you suppose?
Well, you know, a lot of people, of course, who were Forrestal was very upset with the way Israel was created. He was the first critic of Israel. And I think he recognized, a lot of people did at the time, a surprising number of people. And I talked about this in Crimes and Cover-Ups. I don't really go in free, but there was a lot of people were a lot of upset because, you know, they basically created Israel out of other people's land. And they just installed them in the middle of all these kind of warring ethnic people. And they didn't expect something bad to happen. I mean, it wasn't thought out well at all. And Forrestal didn't like it at all. And I think, I don't know if that's the reason he was killed. There are other, you know, supposedly, you know, he, of course he was friends with Joe McCarthy. That could have been a reason in itself. And again, the Kennedys were already enemies of the deep state. He was friends with Joseph. They hated the old man. So it could be just something as simple as that. But however you look at it, I mean, I can't figure out sometimes why. I mean, look what happened to Ivana Trump, you know, last week. I think somebody took her out. I mean, she was a healthy 73-year-old. She's found dead at the bottom of the stairs, and she's got massive trauma to her midsection, but nowhere else. I mean, she was beat with a baseball, but I mean, why would they do that to her? I don't know. But I found enough of these unnatural deaths to know that a lot of times they may not pick the most logical suspect, but the carrying cards are always there. You know, the tendency of somebody wasn't suicidal and falls out of a window or is put out of a window, or in case of McCarthy, somebody goes into the hospital with a knee problem and dies 2 days later and they don't do an autopsy. I mean, that should have been the first thing they'd done. I mean, this is the most controversial figure in America. Of course you're going to order an autopsy. Instead, his enemies like Jack Anderson and Drew Pearson, he was a drunk, he was an alcoholic. Obviously he died of that. Okay, that satisfies the court historians, but some of us want more evidence than that.
Edward R. Murrow kind of made a career out of going after McCarthy, didn't he?
Yeah, sure. And when you have it, so you, it culminates in that movie, it was a good night and whatever, the one with George Clooney. That's what I call Mick history. And that's what they settle on. And I talk a little bit about that in the book. And I talk a lot about Joseph Welch, you know, the Secretary of the Army, who said, "Have you no decency, sir? At long last, have you no decency?" And when they talk about McCarthy, don't play that soundbite. And it's like, mic drop. Oh, but I go into the history behind it and what a phony Welch was and how when the cameras were off, he started laughing and saying, did that go well and everything. And I talk about it in the book. I mean, he had already worked out some kind of a deal or tried to work out a deal with McCarthy. He was no ideologue that was outraged by this. You know, his hands weren't clean, but this is the way the court historians try to portray these things. And they always do it dishonestly. I think McCarthy was a naive but well-meaning guy, and I think they killed him.
You spend a lot of time, you know, obviously writing about the past and uncovering a lot of this corruption and deception and evil. Has anything really changed? I mean, we tend to think now, oh, you know, we're approaching some kind of pivotal moment, you know, like it's never been worse. Are we being cynical, or are we just now hyper attuned to corruption and evil? I mean, are things worse than they were before? In other words,
well, I think they are worse than they were before, but I think they are the way they are because of these things that happened in the past. And that's why I talk about the past as prologue, and the things we see today, transgender story hour, and the crushing of civil liberties, all this stuff. It all has its, that's why I try to show where these things started. So you know, when you see, for instance, when we had the Guantanamo Bay or Gitmo, the light bulbs being stuck up the butts of the prisoners there and those awful pictures and all that stuff, the torch that went on there. You go back to the Mexican-American War, if you don't want to go back to the scorched earth policy and the total war of the Lincoln, and you see the kinds of things that were tolerated then, the rapes and the thefts, the abuse of people, and it goes right through to the Philippines and then in Crimes and Cover-Ups, I talked about all the atrocities that happened by the Allies in World War II, all the rapes. They raped a bunch of German women. They raped so many Japanese women, they had to open a brothel for them on Japan, try to cater to them. And these are our boys. So, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, if that makes me unpatriotic, so be it. But that doesn't mean I think the other guys were necessarily good. But the point is, I don't think we were. I mean, we did a lot of bad things. And so that's what I always try to point out, that it's American exceptionalism is wrongheaded because other than, I think we did create an exceptional system, the founders did, but unfortunately we don't follow it. The people in power don't, they swear to uphold the Constitution, but most of them hate the Constitution, don't believe in it. So it's a joke. I mean, that's why it's hilarious to listen to them talk about the, upholding the Constitution by holding these Soviet-style hearings in Washington that wandered into the Capitol and pictures. I mean, it just, so in that respect, I think it is worse than ever because we're at the point now, especially if they, you know, can succeed. Well, they are, again, they're going to succeed in putting some of these, probably almost all of them in prison for who knows how long, but they have basically criminalized dissent. And that shatters, you know, we have a lawful right to assemble. And you're not going to see that side. They're going to be scared to assemble in the future because they don't want the same thing happen to them. These people have been kept in prison for over a year. They've been denied all due process. They, some of them can't even afford attorneys. And Donald Trump is out collecting $200 million and he's not offering them any money. They're there because of him. He should be financing them. So it's a mess, but yeah, I mean, I'm not looking at it through rose colored glasses, but compared to where we are now, obviously I think it was a lot better, but that's because it was a gradual decline. And these, but it, every time, you know, when you lied about something like McCarthy or certainly the JFK assassination, it's like a graph where you see a steady line down each time that happened and the people didn't demand the truth and they settled for the lies. And then all these lies begat other lies. So at this point, I have quite a job to do trying to expose. I can't keep up with them because there's so many of them. And I invariably miss stuff. And, but it's, that's why I said at this point, anybody, I don't discount anything at this point, any kind of theory, because we know we're being lied to. And so I don't know that necessarily some theories are aliens among us or whatever are more likely than that, but I do know that we're being lied to all the time, so it's reasonable to speculate. People are going to try to find truth somewhere.
We look forward to your upcoming book, Donald. Thank you as always.
Oh, thank you, Richard.
Donald Jeffries.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at StrangePlanetPodcast.com.